Have a very good day.
Today is Tuesday, May 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Belarus continues to face condemnation after the country used a fighter jet to ground a Ryanair passenger flight.
The EU may block its air and ground transport links in and out of Belarus in retaliation.
Plus, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is traveling to the Middle East to ensure the ceasefire between Israel and the militant group Hamas holds. We'll have these stories and more next. The European Union and NATO military alliance said that they may cut off transport links into Belarus after the country used a fighter jet to ground a Ryanair passenger flight and arrest a dissident journalist that was aboard. Reuters' Matthew LaRotonda is up first.
The interception of an Irish airline flight by a Belarus fighter jet, diverting it to land in Belarus, and the subsequent arrest of a dissident journalist aboard has left both the European Union and NATO military alliance scrambling to react to what Ireland is calling an act of piracy. There was also a possible act of espionage involved. Passengers from the flight here disembarking after finally reaching their intended destination in Lithuania. The French president's office has told Reuters that the EU may block its air and ground transport links in and out of Belarus in retaliation. The United States says several American citizens were aboard. Flight tracking data shows airlines are avoiding Belarus airspace. Ryanair Flight 4978 was traveling between Greece and Lithuania Sunday with Roman Protasevich, who had been living in exile and is one of the few remaining independent journalists from Belarus since the government's crackdown on dissent last year. Both Greece and Lithuania are NATO members. Ryanair's CEO says it believes that Belarus had hidden spies aboard the flight who disembarked when it was forced to land in Minsk. This was CEO Michael O'Leary on Irish News Talk Radio Monday.
This was a case of state-sponsored, it was a state-sponsored hijacking, state-sponsored piracy.
This passenger says that the moment the flight captain announced that the plane was diverting to Belarus, that Protasevich shot out of his seat, knowing his time was up.
So the Roman stand up, quickly open the luggage door, take the luggage, and was trying to split the things, like computer, give it to a girlfriend, iPhone or whatever it's called, phone, take to a girlfriend. I think he made a small mistake because there was around plenty of people, so he could give the things not to the girlfriend, which was also, I think, arrested. So we can give it to, let's say, to me or to other passengers.
The passenger says he looked directly into his eyes and saw that he was very sad. A university in Lithuania says one of its students, Sofia Sapega, was arrested as well. In addition to severing transport, Western countries may levy more sanctions on Belarus, but it's not clear what effect that may have. The country has shrugged off similar measures in the past. Belarus said Sunday that it was initially reacting to a false bomb threat on the flight, and its state-owned media says President Alexander Lukashenko personally intervened.
Matthew LaRotonda reports for Reuters News. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said that the United States condemned Lukashenko's ongoing harassment and arbitrary detention of journalists simply for doing their job.
This was a shocking act, diverting a flight between two EU member states for the apparent purpose of arresting a journalist. It constitutes a brazen affront to international peace and security by the regime. We demand an immediate, international, transparent, and credible investigation of this incident. We are in touch with a range of partners bilaterally and through multilateral channels from NATO, the OSCE, UN, EU, and others. And we have nothing to read out at this point, but we will continue to coordinate closely with them.
United Nations spokesperson Stéphane Dujarric said the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, is deeply concerned over the apparent forced landing of a passenger aircraft over Belarus on May 23rd and the subsequent detention of Roman Protasevich. Dujarric also called for a full, transparent, and independent investigation into the incident and urged all relevant actors to cooperate with such an inquiry. United States Secretary of State Antony Blinken will travel to Jerusalem, Ramallah, Cairo, and Amman through Thursday to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, and Jordan's King Abdullah, as well as other top officials. Blinken will focus primarily on ensuring that the ceasefire between Israel and the Palestinian militant group Hamas holds during his visit to the region and work to get assistance delivered to the people of Gaza. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said that U.S. President Joe Biden asked Blinken to travel to the region for a number of reasons.
One is creating sustainable conditions for a ceasefire. Yes, it is holding. We're continuing to watch it, but there's a recognition. We need to continue to discuss and have conversations with our key partners in the region who played an instrumental role in getting to the point we reached last Thursday, and also to discuss the path forward on rebuilding Gaza. And as you noted, Mike, we know that won't be easy, in part because we want to prevent funding from going to Hamas. We obviously don't communicate directly with Hamas, given they're a terrorist organization. A number of countries in the region do. And so the secretary's trip over the next couple of days will be focused on those objectives. And I'm certain he'll have the opportunity to provide a readout to the president when he returns.
Analysts say that there is little chance of reviving Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. And a key reason is the deep divisions within both societies. On the Palestinian side, these are between Hamas, which holds sway in the Gaza Strip, and the Palestinian Authority, which is in the occupied West Bank. In Israel, the challenges stem from the country holding four elections in the past 2 years without producing a clear winner. UN spokesperson Stéphane Dujarric told reporters on Monday that while the ceasefire is holding, it is critical that all parties involved to the hostilities work together to maintain it. According to the Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, routine life was beginning to be restored throughout Gaza. Some of the main roads have been made passable, and the authorities are fixing damaged electrical lines, water, and wastewater networks. Dujarric noted that the Erez crossing is open for international humanitarian personnel and that Israeli authorities have given the UN a green light to use that crossing at Kerem Shalom for the passage of humanitarian goods. But there seems to be a lack of clarity on what goods can actually cross there. Elsewhere, pro-Palestinian demonstrations continued throughout Europe this past weekend. The protests are one result of the Middle East violence that has divided European Union member states and left some fearful of unrest at home. Lisa Bryant has more.
Thousands joined rallies in Paris and other French cities Saturday. Demonstrations echoed in other European capitals in solidarity for the Palestinian cause. At the Place de la République in the French capital, protesters chanted, "Palestine will conquer and Israel assassin," voicing outrage at the recent clashes between Israel and Hamas, which mostly killed Palestinians.
Je dois dire que j'ai honte d'appeler.
Attending the Paris rally, Éric Coquerel, a lawmaker from the far-left France Unbound party, said he was ashamed of his government for allegedly being soft on Israel. His views reflect a broader political divide here, with many on the French left sympathetic to the Palestinians and the right supporting Israel. The European Union's only permanent member on the United Nations Security Council, France worked with Egypt and Jordan last week to help push a ceasefire finally struck between Israel and Hamas on Friday. But overall, some analysts say the EU has been marginalized in this latest spike of Middle East violence, partly because of its fractured response. Countries like Germany, Hungary, and Austria are strongly supportive of Israel. Others like Belgium, Luxembourg, and Sweden are more critical. Still, some analysts note a market pro-Israel tilt across Europe in recent years.
Et donc, on ne peut pas considérer aujourd'hui que c'est fini.
Interviewed Sunday by French media, French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian denied the EU's alleged lack of influence. He called for a policy of small steps to prevent the latest bout of Israeli-Palestinian violence from firing back up. Internal dynamics are also shaping Europe's fractured response. Countries with large Muslim and Jewish populations are fearful of Middle East tensions playing out at home. Germany has seen several recent attacks on synagogues, along with anti-Jewish slurs. In France, with Europe's largest Jewish and Muslim communities, the government banned a pro-Palestinian demonstration earlier this month for fears it would spill into violence.
La situation semble maîtrisée.
So far, says Francis Khalifa, who heads the Representative Council of Jewish Institutions in France, or CRIF, things have stayed generally under control. But Khalifa notes the surge in anti-Jewish attacks in recent years, including several deadly ones. We've experienced this situation before, he said, and we know it can happen again. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. A Palestinian stabbed and wounded two Israelis, one of them a soldier, and was then shot dead on Monday near a flashpoint area of East Jerusalem and had been the focus of Palestinian protests. Orlie Halpern has those details.
Teenage Palestinian, 17 years old, stabbed two people, one of them a soldier, in Jerusalem, more or less on the border of East and West, near the Israel Police headquarters. And one person was seriously injured and the other less so. This comes, you know, after we've reached the ceasefire, Hamas and Israel. The situation, first thing to set it off, was this issue over the eviction of Palestinians by Israel in the East Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, which is very close to where that stabbing took place. That issue hasn't been resolved. It's that issue, these, you know, few homes with Palestinians living them that Israeli settlers want to take over and kick out the Palestinians, has become such an enormous issue. It sparked this 11-day war between Israel and Hamas. And it still hasn't let up. And we see that just because, you know, one Gaza war is over doesn't mean that this issue is resolved. And indeed, the Israeli High Court has yet to meet to make its final decision about whether these Palestinians will be evicted.
From Jerusalem, that was reporter Orlie Halpern. The head of the World Health Organization warns vaccine inequity is prolonging the COVID-19 pandemic. And this crisis will not end until transmission of the coronavirus is stopped in all countries. WHO Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus spoke at the opening session of the 74th World Health Assembly, and Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus paid tribute Monday to the courage of the many health and care workers who have worked valiantly to save the lives of millions of people, often at the cost of their own lives. He estimates 150,000 have died, many because they lacked the personal protective equipment and vaccines that could have saved them. He accused the wealthy countries of hoarding life-saving vaccines and perpetuating the pandemic. He notes more than 75% of all vaccines have been administered in just 10 countries. This compared to just 2% of doses in the poorer countries. He called this vaccine inequity scandalous. He said it was unconscionable. A small group of countries that make and buy most of the world's vaccines control the fate of the rest of the world. He added the global situation remains very fragile, and wealthy countries should not be complacent about their ability to beat the virus.
No country should assume it's out of the woods, no matter its vaccination rate. This virus is changing constantly. Future changes could render our tools ineffective and drag us back to square one.
Tedros said one of the greatest drivers of this pandemic has been the lack of international solidarity and the sharing of data, information, pathogens, resources, and technology.
We can only address that fundamental weakness with a binding commitment between nations to provide a solid foundation for enhanced cooperation, a treaty on pandemic preparedness and response that can address the challenges that I have outlined, an international agreement that represents all nations and people.
Discussions are expected to take place at the Assembly on whether to begin negotiations on formulating a legally binding pandemic treaty to better prepare for and prevent infectious outbreaks. To date, the WHO Framework Convention on Tobacco Control is the only treaty that has been negotiated under the auspices of the World Health Organization. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Repeated tremors shook the Democratic Republic of Congo city of Goma Monday, unnerving families still reeling from a volcano eruption at the weekend that destroyed nearby villages, displaced thousands, and killed at least 32 people. Mount Nyiragongo, one of the world's most active and dangerous volcanoes, erupted on Saturday evening. The lava flow stopped a few hundred meters short of the city limits, but wrecked 17 villages along the way, cut the principal electricity supply, and blocked a major road, which has disrupted aid deliveries. Multiple reports say military officials in Mali have arrested the country's president and prime minister on Monday, just months into their tenure. President Ba Ndao, Prime Minister Mokhtar Ouane, as well as Defense Minister Soleimani Doucouré, were taken to a military base outside the capital of Bamako, according to Reuters and the French news agency AFP. The news closely follows a reshuffle of the country's government, in which two members of the military junta that seized power in an August coup were replaced. Myanmar's state television on Monday aired pictures of ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi for the first time since a military coup nearly 4 months ago. The images were part of her first in-person court appearance since Suu Kyi's arrest. MRTV, in its nightly news bulletin, showed Suu Kyi on a dock, sitting upright with her hands in her lap and wearing a surgical mask. Beside her was ousted President Win Myint and another defendant, former Naypyidaw Mayor Myo Aung, as two police officers stood behind them. Suu Kyi looked in good health during the 30-minute meeting with her legal team, which said that she had no access to newspapers in detention and was only partially aware of what was happening outside.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers at the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis have found people who recovered from mild cases of COVID-19 months earlier still have immune cells that continue to produce antibodies against the disease-causing SARS coronavirus 2. The researchers say their findings suggest that those who had mild COVID-19 may have long-lasting antibody protection from the disease. Past studies implied that antibody protection in COVID-19 patients decreased once the infection was resolved. When infected with a virus, our body's immune system starts to crank out antibodies to fight the infection. Researchers say once the infection has been eliminated, most of those antibodies do die off, but a small amount of them move to and settle in our bone marrow, where they continue to release low levels of protective antibodies into the bloodstream. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. May 25th marks the one-year anniversary since a white police officer in Minneapolis, Minnesota, killed George Floyd, a black man. Now, some relatives of other alleged police brutality victims in the U.S. want their cases reopened and are inspired by the verdict in the Floyd case. However, it's not so clear-cut. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias looks at the complexities of their quest to seek justice. But please be advised, this report does contain language that some may find disturbing.
A few steps from where Tracy and her brother Paul stand, their sibling, Leonard Shand, was gunned down by police on September 26, 2019. The family's lawyer gave VOA videos he obtained from the authorities. They show an almost 40-minute standoff with 10 officers of three departments in Prince George's County, Maryland. They demanded that Shan drop two knives. Shan's family says police used excessive force and inflamed the scenario that ultimately led to his shooting death.
They killed him before the crisis intervention showed up. He didn't trust cops, so it would have made an absolute difference. And you got to remember, he wasn't hostile all the time. He got hostile when they tried to hit him with the vehicle. He got hostile when they tried to kick him in his back.
In the United States, the justice system handles cases of alleged police brutality as criminal or civil matters, sometimes both. Because it is the police who investigate crimes, there's an automatic conflict of interest.
The victim's family is able to bring civil charges to that officer, against that officer, relating to any types of victimization that that individual and their family member suffered. Now, with regards to criminal charges, that has to be brought on by the government. The controversy is that prosecutors are so used to working with law enforcement. They depend on law enforcement to provide them with that evidence.
Then there is transparency. In Maryland and most states, a grand jury, that's a panel of ordinary citizens, reviews the evidence from police and prosecutors to decide if cops should be charged.
The problem with the grand jury is it is secret. It happens behind closed doors with one prosecutor and no other lawyer for the victim. We don't even know what charges were suggested.
The grand jury voted not to charge the officers involved in Shan's shooting. The prosecutor called the process thorough and transparent and said she isn't open to reviewing it.
The use of force expert looked at every single angle, reviewed every piece of video footage, reviewed every witness statement, and applied the law.
The Fraternal Order of Police Union has pushed back on the nationwide drive to reopen cases, including Shan's.
I guess I would just be fearful that you could reopen and keep cases open indefinitely until you got the answer that you wanted to get. And that's not how our justice system works.
There's been political pressure on some high-profile cases, like the 2014 shooting death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, 12-year-old Tamir Rice in Cleveland, and the 2015 death of Freddie Gray of spine injuries after his arrest in Baltimore.
Even when an officer is not indicted, it still doesn't mean that people didn't find what happened to be egregious. And oftentimes in civil court is where we see the shift.
Settlement of civil misconduct cases is paid by states, cities, and counties with insurance and or taxpayer money. What's called, quote, qualified immunity, unquote, shields individual officers from personal financial responsibility for actions on duty.
That's something that is very controversial. That's an issue that's not only being taken up at the state and local level, but also nationally.
Legislation repealing qualified immunity passed the U.S. House in March. Brave Boy said her county is improving police training while beefing up mental health units. And she welcomed the police reform package Maryland recently passed. Leonard Shan's siblings know there's little chance of getting a new criminal investigation and are hoping to find justice through an ongoing civil lawsuit. But they know it can never be complete. Money, if they get any, won't bring Leonard back.
This is a human life. So, I mean, what compensation, you know, could there be? I feel heartache because I know what he wanted to do and what he was currently in the process of doing with his life. And now he's just, it's just cut down, you know, and that's a horrible, horrible thing.
Veronica Valderas Iglesias for VOA News, Prince George's County, Maryland.
And finally, the coronavirus pandemic has taken a toll on people's mental health, causing a wide range of fears over the past year of precautions, protocols, lockdowns, and isolation. VOA reporters met with several Americans to discuss their experiences roughly a year into the pandemic. And in this first segment of Alone Together, we hear about some of the biggest fears and anxieties faced by Sayashi Little Dave, Kevin Mahoney, Nicole McKinney, Henry Johnson, Sherry Arnold, Dave Arnold, Catherine Lieberman, Madeline Arnold, and Angela Connor.
When COVID-19 first came on the scene, I had actually a lot of fears and a lot of anxiety. And initially, a lot of the concerns were around older people who were more at risk. So I immediately had fears, anxiety about my parents, especially my dad. My dad's really high risk.
I'm vaccinated. I'm still ultra cautious. 2 masks, social distance. I don't go out. I don't go to restaurants. But that's in the interest of public safety. I've had 5 bypasses in my heart 2 years ago. You know, coagulation issues because COVID causes your blood vessels to react strangely. Terrified each day, like, if I get it, I'm not going to, I don't think I'm going to make it.
In the very beginning, a lot of people were scared. And so we saw a significant decline as far as, like, people calling 911. And I think that was bad in a way because people were scared to go to the ER, but they know that they needed help, but then they were waiting, like, almost too long.
I am in recovery for serious mental illness myself. I am more vulnerable to uncertainty and anxiety due to not knowing. I have been terrified of mutations. From the very beginning, when I heard of the option to, you know, mass expose and achieve herd immunity that way, that caused me nightmares. The idea that this vaccine isn't going to be enough, that's what keeps me up at night.
Losing my father in January, that was my worst fear, you know, for the elderly people in our family.
The worst fears for me is I contract it and don't make it, and I leave wife and child behind. That's my worst nightmare.
My husband is a teacher and was exposed by students who refused to wear masks, and the result was that he got sick. And I thought that was the worst of it until last week. I thought maybe we were gonna come out the other side. And we lost a cousin to coronavirus. And that was my biggest fear, and it was realized.
Emotions are a lot right now to deal with, because it's so hard to deal with this. We never would have thought this would ever happen before. We weren't prepared, and we didn't know how we were going to feel about it. And sometimes just like, I'm stuck. I have 10 assignments that are missing, and everything's due in 2 weeks, and I have no clue what to do. I'm stuck.
I think teenagers feel more anxiety now. They no longer have their face-to-face peer interactions. They no longer have their safe places to go. They don't no longer have teachers or counselors or their support systems or outreach to. More so, it's just the therapist, and it's virtual, which makes it, you know, super stressful. You know, a lot of teenagers have lost people because of COVID, and that's brought about a lot of challenges for them to function.
And everybody keeps calling it, you know, the new normal, but the new normal is kind of, it's comforting for me because, you know, I know what the expectations are, and I know, you know, wear your mask and wash your hands, you know.
One of the things that decreases my anxiety is unplugging. I found that taking time off, not watching the news, you know, multiple hours a day, you know, doing things like listening to music or meditating, you know, they help a lot more.
And that'll do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.